to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host, Paul Wearson, along with my co-hosts today, Isaac Beal and Dalton Gackle. Hello, guys, and hello to all you out there.
On today's show, we will have three guests coming live into the studio. For starters, do you know what an earwig is? Well, it's a bug. Donald Lewis of the Iowa State Entomology Department will speak about the rise in earwigs in Iowa, as well as localized Japanese beetle spikes.
Later in the show, Story City's City Administrator Mark Jackson will give some insight into what's happening in Story City. To finish off, we have an interesting story about a new thing, virtual tours on farms. Nicole Jonas from Red Granite Farm will come in with her son Gabe, and they'll tell us a little bit about the virtual education program they recently participated in.
I'm Dalton Gackle, and now let's talk about earwigs with Donald Lewis. Earwigs are a fairly common insect, and people recognize them, but most people don't know what an earwig actually is or what they do. Donald, what type of insect is an earwig?
Well, earwigs are their own group. They aren't really closely related to anything else. They are an order of insects all by themselves. Earwigs are one of those things that you either already know about or you haven't seen yet, and I think there are two kinds of people in the world, those who have earwigs and those who will have earwigs. When I came from Ohio way back in 1977, I thought I had left earwigs behind because they were common in Ohio where I grew up, and then I came to Iowa. But those who are old enough remember that 1977 and that era was one of the drought years in Iowa, one of the severe drought years. And the consequence of a drought is populations of insects that like moisture outdoors are lower. And so I came to an era where they really weren't here. Well, since those droughts of the 70s and 80s, we've had some more normal years, we've had good moisture, and especially over the last couple 2 to 3 years, we've had enough moisture to bring earwigs back to the fore, and people find them in their gardens, they find them in their landscapes, they find them in their flower beds, in their containers, and most annoyingly of all, they find them in their house.
So can you describe for the listener what an earwig looks like?
They are a long, skinny insect, but by long, I mean only half an inch. We're not talking about anything gigantic. We're not talking about something huge that's going to come in and cause a lot of problems. They're only half an inch long. They're fairly slender. Brown, kind of a reddish-brown color, but like in all insects, they have 6 legs. The distinguishing feature, though, on the tail end, they have a pair of pinchers. And these elongated pinchers are about a third of the length of the body. So it's really a dominant feature on the end. Earwigs have wings, but the wings are sort of tucked up under these little pads, and we really don't notice them. The other thing about earwigs that people know is they move quickly. They run. They're very fast. And when they run, they hold their tail end up in the air. They hold their pinchers up in the air, and they wiggle their pinchers back and forth as they're running across your carpet, across your countertop, or across your landscape, across your sidewalk. And it's that wiggling of their tail end while they run which gives them the name earwig, wig for wiggle.
Gotcha. So what do they do with this pincer? Are they a dangerous insect?
They can't hurt you with it. It's a they use it for both offense and defense, and I think the males and females, who both have pinchers in this case, I think the males and females use them in a combat that precedes mating, but it's they use them to help with lots of things, but it's not a danger to us. It's not like pinching bugs that have these huge mandibles on the front that can crush your finger or break your skin. The pinchers are a little more ornamental than that, so earwigs are not dangerous to us. They're not a real threat. They can't bite. They don't sting. They don't carry diseases. They are a little bit of an annoyance to people when they get into the house. They can feed on our landscape, but they're not a personal threat to us.
All right. So what do they do as in terms of the environment? How do they operate in the environment?
They are recyclers. They are one of nature's many critters that help break down organic matter, and because they're recyclers and scavengers, they're out there feeding on a variety of different things. Earwigs can feed on plant material, they can feed on dead decaying material, they can attack insects and little insect eggs and so forth. So by being scavengers, what they are doing ecologically is being recyclers. They're taking organic matter, breaking it down, digesting it, and returning the nutrients to the environment. So ecologically, they're like a lot of things, that we can find something good to love about most insects. An entomologist can even find something good to love about cockroaches, because cockroaches are also recyclers. But earwigs are in that group, that they have a beneficial ecological role. We just wish they would do it and leave us out of it a little more.
One of the reasons people have probably heard about earwigs, or at least know of them, because they do see them in their house. But one of the other main reasons that people know about earwigs is because of the folklore that goes with them. Could you explain that folklore and how it came to be a little bit?
Earwigs, like lots of other insects, will on occasion accidentally crawl into your ear canal. And there is this myth that came from Europe, where the European earwig came from, that earwigs purposefully, that is, they intentionally crawl into your ears for the purpose of laying eggs. That's a superstition. That's a myth. It's not a lie that earwigs can get into your ears. But cockroaches, moths, flies, ladybugs can also climb into your ear. So that part is not a myth. The myth is that they did it on purpose, that there was an intentional direction toward your ear for the purpose of laying eggs. Of course, some late-night television has picked this up, and you can find horror movies and horror shows where this happens, that the earwig burrows into someone's brain, lays eggs, and they go screaming into the night ever after. So it's a popular myth. It's pretty well known, but if an earwig is into your ear, it's there because it needed a dark, moist place to hide, which is where they hide anyway. If they're outside in your garden, they're hiding in a damp location. They're under the mulch, they're under the leaf litter, they're under the dead plant material on the ground, where there will be moisture. And if your ear canal is moist, it just looks like a good place to hide to an earwig.
So the moral of the story is keep your ears clean and dry, I guess.
Dry out your ears. That's good advice for everybody.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Local Talk on KHOY 89.1 FM. Donald Lewis, a professor in the entomology department at Iowa State, has been explaining what earwigs are. We are experiencing a larger amount of earwigs in Iowa than normal this summer, which is why we are talking about them. So why is that, Donald? Why are there more of them this summer?
I think it's all weather related. We have always had earwigs, but as I said earlier, it seemed like we went through pretty low population numbers for a long, long time, and people got out of the habit of seeing them. They didn't notice them any longer, and we sort of dropped them from our collective consciousness, I guess. But the damper weather, especially the wetter spring weather of the last several years, has allowed the populations to increase. As I mentioned, earwigs are going to live and thrive where there is moisture and decaying organic matter. And in drought years, when everything has turned dry, they just don't find that habitat and their populations decline as a result. The opposite, when we have good rainfall in the spring and the ground stays moist, there's lots of decaying organic matter on the ground, the earwig populations grow. So people may be seeing more earwigs this year, but it's not because of the wet weather we had this year. It's the wet weather over the past several springs and falls that have allowed the population to increase to where it is. Now, what is a lot of earwigs depends on who you are and how you feel about them. People who find one or two in their house may think that's a lot. But when we go outside and when we look under leaf litter, we can find that there are dozens and hundreds of them right outside. So it's not an overwhelming number. It's not like hordes of grasshoppers in the plagues of out on the Great Plains. We have a lot of earwigs, but it's not a horrendous number. But I hate to say that to people who have found several inside their house. They have them crawling into their basement, because any of these insects inside seems like too many. But the populations vary greatly from place to place. Some people find one or two. Some people find lots.
Yeah, I know I've seen an increase in the amount of earwigs coming into my apartment. So, So with this spike, how is this spike or how can this spike affect the environment and the food chain?
Well, it's all weather driven, and we know that when we get good rain throughout the years, we get more corn, and when we get more rain in the springtime, we get a few other kinds of insects, and when we get periodic rainfalls throughout the summer, we know our mosquito populations blossom, and when we don't get rainfall in the summer, we know our aphid populations go up, and when the aphid population goes up in the early summer, the ladybug population goes up in the fall. So it seems like weather drives lots of these other things, and when we get lots of rainfall in this last week of June, we have fewer grasshoppers. So there are all these correlations that we have made over time, and the ecosystem adjusts to all these changes, and populations rise and fall. One of the things I always tell my students is there's only one species on Earth whose population increases every year without fail, and that's humans. Insects, on the other hand, go through explosions and crashes, and there will be years they are up and there are years they are down, largely weather dependent.
And I'm sure people are going to want to know now that we've been talking about them sneaking into houses and whatnot, how do you keep these things out of your house?
That's the first thing to remember, is that every earwig you find in your house came from outside. I don't think you could raise earwigs inside. You just don't have enough moisture. You don't have the habitat. The earwigs that are in your house all crawled through a crack or a gap. What can we do to find and eliminate those cracks and gaps? And I can tell you that even people who build brand new energy efficient houses still find the occasional earwig, they find the occasional millipede, they find these accidental invaders that have wandered into their house. But the first step would be, is there a place we can seal up a crack or a gap? Can we do better thresholds across the door? Can we seal the windows? Is there a gap between the foundation and the siding? These are all places we would try to seal. Some people will resort to insecticides, and I think putting the insecticides inside your house to control earwigs is the wrong approach, that we don't need the insecticide inside to kill them after they're already in. If we were going to use insecticides at all, we would put them around the outside of the house in order to kill them before they entered. So if we can treat those cracks and gaps under the doors, around the windows, the gap between the foundation and the siding, we could use a household insecticide to try to create a barrier to stop them from getting in. Going out further than that, because they live under the mulch, they live under the leaf litter, it's going to be hard to use enough insecticide outside to get the insecticide to where they live. You're going to have to rake back the mulch. You're going to have to spray the insecticide, then put the mulch back. That's going to be a lot of work and probably very little benefit. So the choices come down to, can you seal them out by excluding them with better control of cracks and gaps? If not, is it at all possible for you to tolerate them and live with them? And that's the practical answer. For those that are inside, pick them up and throw them back outside. If they're feeding on your petunia blossoms, we can use insecticides on the plants. But, again, that's going to be hard to do because they live in damp locations where insecticides aren't going to work well. So there are these options. None of them are good options, and that's one of the frustrations with working with this particular pest.
And then similar to earwigs, there are also some localized spikes in Japanese beetles in Iowa. So just briefly, what is their role in the environment? And then why the spike? Is it the same as the earwigs?
It's a little more complicated, but it's much the same story in that for both earwigs and Japanese beetles, these are immigrants that came to the United States accidentally. They were brought here. In the case of the Japanese beetle, they arrived on the Atlantic seaboard in 1916. So this is not a new insect to the United States. It arrived in Iowa in 1994. The first recorded Japanese beetle in Ames, Iowa, was in 2001, found by a master gardener in downtown Ames. So they've been here for a long time, and many of us went through an explosive outbreak of Japanese beetles in our landscapes back between about 2008 and 2012, and that would be here in Ames. For other parts of the state, it was earlier than that, and certainly for the eastern United States, it was much earlier than that. Then, in the winter of 2013-14, we went into the winter with a particularly dry soil, and it stayed frozen for a particularly long period of time, and that was damaging to the grubs, the larvae of the Japanese beetle that are in the soil over the winter. So we came into the summer of 2014 with very, very low numbers of Japanese beetles, and those of us who had been through the outbreaks in the previous part of the decade thought, free at last, no more Japanese beetles. So we went through a couple of years of very low numbers, but the population never went away. It was just reduced, and now they're building back up. And people who didn't have the outbreak earlier seem to be the ones who are taking their turn this time. So the thing about Japanese beetles is that they're very spotty. You can have them in one neighborhood, but not the next neighborhood. You can have them in one backyard and not the next backyard. You can have them in one county and not the next county. Sooner or later, everyone will have them, but right now we're still in this invasion phase of this particular exotic insect, and not everybody has seen them yet, but sooner or later, almost everyone will.
The earwigs we talked about earlier, they aren't really considered pests in terms of damaging, like, plant life and stuff in our gardens. Are these Japanese beetles considered pests?
By everybody. Nobody likes Japanese beetles, it turns out. Japanese beetle is the quintessential generalist. They will feed on about 350 different plant species. They are phytophagous. They feed on plant material, but they will feed on the flowers, foliage, and fruit of about 350 different kinds of plants. Their favorites are linden trees, roses, and grapes, and those are the places that people find them. The linden trees along 24th Street not that long ago, the linden trees down on Airport Road, the linden trees on Pamel Drive and campus, they turned brown in the summer back in 2008 to 2012 because of defoliation by the Japanese beetle. Defoliation does not equal death. So those trees look fine today. They recovered from that defoliation, but it's hard to put up with those brown trees. And when they're eating your roses, you're getting fewer blooms. And if you're a grape grower, losing the foliage means you're losing your yield. So they are an economic pest because they feed on so many crops that we depend upon, but they're also an aesthetic pest because they feed on the plants that we love to look at.
All right. So if you're growing roses, be aware of Japanese beetles. Thank you very much, Donald, for telling us about earwigs and Japanese beetles. You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI. This song is Buggin' Out by A Tribe Called Quest.
Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5 foot assassin with the roughneck business. I float like gravity, never had a cavity. Got more rhymes than the one that's got family. No need to sweat Arsenio to gain some type of fame. No shame in my game, cause I always be the same. Styles upon styles upon styles is what I have. You wanna diss the viper, but you still don't know the half. I sport New Balance sneakers to avoid a narrow path. Messing around with this to catch the size of the... I never have stuff, cause I'm not a half stepper. Drink a lot of soda, so they call me Dr. Pepper. Refuse to compete with BS competition. Your name is specialist, so won't you suckle with the mission? I never walk the streets, think it's all about me. Even though deep in my heart, it really could be. I just try my best to, like, go all out. Some might even say, yo, shorty black, you're bugging out.
Zulu Nation, mother's last creation. Minds get flooded. Ejaculation, right on the 2-inch tape. The abstract poet incognito runs the cape, not the best, not the worst. And occasionally I curse to get my point across. So bust the force as I go in between the grit and the dirt. Listen to the mission, listen, missions I do work. As I crack the monotone, chilling up the jazz, so get your own. Smoking R&B, cause they try to dupe me. All the best of the back, but they can't do rap force abs. Original, you can't get your own, and that's pitiful. I know I'd be the man if I cold yank the plug on R&B, but I can't. And that's...
Well, welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Radio. I'm Paul Wearson, one of your hosts for today, together with Isaac Beale and Dalton Gackle. The song we just heard was Buggin' Out by A Tribe Called Quest. And we were just talking about bugs in Iowa this summer with Donald Lewis of the Iowa State University Entomology Department. And now we'd like to welcome Mark Jackson, the Story City Administrator. He's joined us. Thanks for coming, Mark.
Good morning, Paul.
And welcome back. I know you've been to KHOI before. Tell us, what kind of a summer are we having in Story City?
It's hot. Is that the answer you want, Paul? Pretty good so far.
But we're working on a lot of things.
Yes.
With a swimming pool and...
Some improvements in the... Yeah, we're doing a major renovation in the South Park. And let's see what else. You know, and so probably... Actually, where we're at right now, Paul, is that we're actually getting ready for 2017 already. So we're starting with plans for stuff like that. So 2016, stuff that's under construction. Yeah, you have change orders and things like that, but now we're actually getting ready for 2017 and looking at a little beyond that as well.
Well, now the swimming pool construction, that's going to be far more of an aquatic-type center, right? That'll be done by next year.
Yeah, we'll be open by Memorial Day of next year. We actually, by the terms of the contract we went with this year, we actually let them start in the fall of 2015, and basically we knew that we would be closed down for one summer there. In fact, most people say that I like that because pools are money losers. It's a great thing.
Is that right?
Oh, sure. You know, you don't make any money at a pool. Now, maybe the aquatic center down here in Ames, it may break even. In fact, what study shows, pools even like that, they may make money for the first 3-4 years. But then after that, most pools don't make money. So, you know, they are subsidized, but it's a great quality of life for a community. So we actually save money, Paul, by not having a swimming pool for 1 year.
That's great. Now, the South Park right now, you know, historically, that's been kind of a rustic place.
And you got to, you know, one of the things I do admire about is the naming of our parks. We have a South Park and a North Park. And in case you're wondering, one is on the south side of town and the other's on the north side of town, which I thought was rather ingenious by our founding fathers, Paul.
I think so, too. They're just remarkable. In fact,
because you never have to ask for directions. Where's the South Park? Go south.
Yeah, I think Norwegians know the directions on the dial, you know. And so we go north and south.
Sure.
Well, now, how was Scandinavian Days this year? It's our annual festival in Story City.
You know, it was good. I mean, I went to a couple of things. I didn't run the race this year, Paul, but, you know, I let somebody else win it this year. So I decided not to participate. But, of course, you know, we always go to the musical. That's always one of the most enjoyable things you do is Judge Story's theatrical troupe is doing their musical and, of course, the parade. And I think one of the things that this year for the parade was, you know, one of our long-term leading citizens who passed away shortly after, Rich Olive, was one of the honorary parade marshals this year. So I think that made it a little extra special this year in Story City.
And he passed away shortly after that.
Yeah, June 20th was when he passed away. So it was a couple of weeks after that.
And Rich was very instrumental in all the economic development taking place over the past few years. And you might highlight some of the things that have happened in Story City during your tenure.
Well, I've been, you know, Paul, I've been here a really long time. We came in 1993, and shortly after that, I mean, Rich began his time in economic development in the late 80s. When American Packaging came there. And so Rich is president of the EDC for a long time, and myself as a city administrator, we were really partners in a lot of economic development. You know, Rich was, you know, we always said we were kind of like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. You know, I just sort of sat there, kind of looked pretty, I think. Rich was the salesman, and my job was to make the numbers work, and it was a great partnership that worked for a long time. And you sort of look around the community and you see what's there now. Pella Corporation isn't there anymore. It's Winfield Solutions now, or Precision, Endoshell Precision Machine and Manufacturing, and EB, American Packaging. I mean, the list just kind of goes on, Paul. And, you know, one of the things you look at Story City is what helps us a lot on the financial end is where we make money is commercial industrial development. And Story City is about 47% property tax basis commercial industrial development. And when you look at Iowa, Story City's population, when people come in, think we're a town of about 9,000. We're really about 3,500. So we've done quite well economically, and a lot of that's attributed to Rich's leadership on the EDC, along with a whole host of other individuals over the years.
Well, you know, I grew up in Story City. When I grew up, it was 1,600 people. And mm-hmm. so it's roughly doubled over the decades. And I think that one thing that you have to have when you do economic development is find the appropriate company, you know, the one that fits in, the one that creates jobs, the one that dovetails with what the city plan is.
Well, you know, and that's a good point, because one of the things that we really like to focus on, one of the things we liked is that we liked family-owned companies. You know, Pella's still a family-owned company. EB Manufacturing. They're out of Blue Ball, Pennsylvania. They're a family-owned company. Even American Packaging Corporation, as large as they are, is a family-owned company. So a lot of our focus has really tended to be on those manufacturing companies that have been family-owned. And I think that sort of fits in what Story City it really tends to be all about.
Now, what are some of the we've done very well in Story City, but what are some of the challenges that you foresee on the horizon? You know, we're talking not only about Story City, but Iowa towns in general.
Well, it's the continuation, and, you know, I always say Story City sort of really always at that tipping point where, you know, around the interstates we'll be all right because of that. And we're within 10 miles of Iowa State University, and so we'll be solid because of that. So we'll always be a solid community, but whether we grow or not is really dependent upon ourselves because we are still 10 miles away from Iowa State University. So the real one of the largest challenges we have now is the need for land for housing development. And so it's probably the largest challenge we have. And like I said, Paul, housing does not make money for a city. It really doesn't. When you do the numbers, for every house that you have there with people, you provide them for every dollar they pay in taxes, it costs you $1.25 to pay in services. So really, money, you don't make money on housing. But housing's really a key for schools. And that's really in terms of what you see, not just Story City, but a lot of small towns in Iowa, a couple of things you're seeing happening. Without really any new housing starts, you get no new kids. And so that's really the significant thing in terms of housing development is really that's what keeps your schools going. So for us, that's a real key. And then, of course, you need to always be growing. That was one of the things I think Rich and I and a number of others really pushed for. Even though we were recruiting companies and getting them there, we were always still recruiting companies because companies leave. And that's what's gotten a lot of is we've emptied out the manufacturing base in the United States since the early 1980s. That's really hit small-town Iowa pretty hard. And so a lot of them are going to struggle. In fact, some of the numbers I get from the – I think it's the Iowa League of Cities or where it's come from – is that 75-80% of towns in Iowa are losing population. And that's just going to be a struggle for a number of them in the years to come.
And I think Story City, the prospects are good, but you're unique in that ownership and surrounding land is such that – it's hard to expand north and south. And so east and west are your options. Now, you've got industry east and west.
And the city owns all that prime industrial commercial development land on the interstate. That was one of the things that the city council and the EDC had a lot of foresight was entering into some options on some property along the interstate and then exercising those options. You know, it's sort of interesting. Back when we did those, a lot of that land we bought was for $7,000 and $10,000 an acre. And back then they thought, oh my God, that's just outrageous. And today they think we're financial geniuses. So time has a way of working itself out, Paul.
There's a lot of quality of life issues too. And I know that one of the things that I see in Story City that always impressed me is the Trees Forever program. Talk about that. It's just great.
Well, yeah, you know, and really that really goes a lot to Mike Jensen and Denny Michael and John Moran. I think those three are kind of the and a number of other volunteers, especially the Scouts. That started in, 92, I think it is. And, Mike's done a value of it. It's over $500,000 of value in terms of volunteer time and effort and the value of the trees that's been invested in Story City since the early 1990s. So, I mean, they've just done a wonderful job.
And they've been creative about varying the species according to what diseases could occur. You know?
Yeah, we don't talk about that one in Story City that's throughout Iowa right now. It's kind of a...
The Emerald Ash Borer.
Yeah, that's... yeah.
That's our... Other than earwigs, it's our big enemy, right?
It seems to be that way.
But I really am impressed by the activity there. And it's really symptomatic of what I see in Story City in terms of volunteerism, period. When you look at the opportunities to volunteer in every town, they exist. But you have several things going on in Story City every year that are really dependent on volunteers and participation.
Yeah, that's one. That's interesting that you bring that up because that's one of the things that I've seen significant change of over the years. And what I mean by that is You used to have a lot of volunteerism in the community, particularly with service groups, and you really don't see that kind of volunteerism anymore. And so one of the things there was a real concern of in a lot of small towns, is there going to be volunteers? And that sort of dropped off. But what I really see with this new generation, it's a different form of volunteerism. It's actually volunteerism is coming back in a number of communities. It's just in a different way. And that's once you realize what that is and how you can tap into that, it goes really well.
By the way, we're on KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City and surrounding area. And our guest on Local Talk today, among others, is Mark Jackson. He's city administrator for Story City. And Mark, what's the next big thing at Story City?
Well, like I said, we're really talking about 2017. You know, you're going to see a lot of infrastructure improvements. Communities are always doing that. But I think probably the next thing you'll do is, as I mentioned, we're redoing the South Park right now. Next year, we're going to start the first phases of the North Park, which are really going to change the look and how things are done in the North Park. Particularly, the first phase has to do around the tennis courts area, the carousel, and then through the bandshell. We'll do where the creek runs through it. We're going to split it into two. We'll do one side first and then the other side after that. So you'll see a real redevelopment, refurbishing, transformation of that whole North Park. And you know, as Roger Austin, you know Roger, a longtime community activist in Story City. And one of the reasons why I came is there isn't one of the – it's one of the most beautiful entrances into a community of Story City when you get off the interstate.
Oh, yes.
It really is. I mean, I remember still coming in 1993. You have the golf course on one side. And then you start coming in where you see the schools. You're a baseball fan like I am. A number of years ago, I was watching – there was an all-star game, and we were playing Ames, Little League. And you had the swimming, and it was a night game, and you had a ball game going on at the carousel field, kids swimming at the pool, and the carousel going. And I remember it was Dr. Sorrentino, Mark Sorrentino, I was sitting next to, and he goes, you know, this is what small town America is really all about. It was just quite a scene, and I think that's the kind of scene where you still try to capture day in and day out.
Well, I have an anecdote, too. Years ago when we had the Standard station uptown on Broad, a man had his car towed in off the interstate, and I was stopping there for gas, and he was looking a little perplexed, but he said, you know, I'm really glad I got towed in. This is a beautiful town because you have the – he mentioned what you did. You go by the golf course and the tennis courts and all this sort of thing. And one of the great things we're famous for in Story City is the carousel, and that was a – what was that, the early 80s when – they got together and refurbished this carousel we've owned since the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And the volunteer effort and fundraising, that was terrific.
You know, that's Story City's calling card. I mean, you know, when you go anywhere else in the United States or in Iowa, when they mention even the Des Moines Register, you know, places to go to in Iowa is the antique carousel. And you look at the map, there's 20,000 rides that take place a year there.
20,000?
20,000. You look at the map there. People come in and put pins in, and they come from all 50 states. Every year in the United States, there's at least 12, 15 countries that people come from as well. And that's, I mean, I have friends from Michigan that come out every year or every other year, and the first thing they want to do is, or what they want to do is take their grandkids or their kids on the carousel. And it's just one of Iowa's most unique attraction. It sits there right in the entrance into Story City.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I volunteered at the carousel, and it's fun to watch the small children. They're either terrified or elated.
Yeah, I did mine over the 4th of July. You love the rides. The worst thing about it is after listening to that music for 2 to 3 hours, it sort of stays with you for a while.
Oh, yes, it's the old Wurlitzer.
It's nothing you guys are going to play here on the radio. No. Let's just say that right. I mean, it's great for the carousel, but boy, listening to it for 2 or 3 hours, the same stuff. Oh, boy.
It's the old Wurlitzer, and all this is stuff from vintage times, early 20th century. And I call it the hits of the 1890s that play on there.
You know, and a couple of years ago, they refurbished all the horses on the carousel and the animals and the benches and all that sort of thing. So it really looks just really great right now.
Oh, yeah. You can ride horses. You can ride roosters.
Pigs and roosters.
And then you can get in this little tub that you can, I've seen kids accelerate that to where you train astronauts. You know, they're pulling 5 G's in there. So Story City really has made a lot of progress. It's really lurking there for the future, and everything looks good. The employer mix is good. What about financing? Is it always tricky to finance new projects or bonding and that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, let's just say the state makes it tougher for us all the time on some stuff. They always, you know, it's changing rules and regulations. You know, and actually from even the 2008, there's a lot of new rules and regulations from the Securities and Exchange Commission. You know, wouldn't think about that. They would impact us in Story City, but yeah, it does. You know, we have the highest bond rating you can for a community of our size. I think, you know, we've had – the one thing I think we've really had that's been – excellent over the years is we've had very progressive and financially astute city council members, and that helps as well. And so, you know, one of the things we do is we always project out 3 to 5 years on our financials. And I think that gives us, you know, a financial plan on what we should do. And yeah, it gets a little harder at times, but I think if you plan it out, I think you do all right. And I think it's like some of the projects we have that we have coming up, you know, Paul, I can talk about what we're going to do 2, 3, 5 years down the road. I mean, that's the sort of planning I think we do. So financially, as my neighbor would say, better than most.
Well, you know, one thing I notice, too, when I compare Story City with other towns, it seems that you have quite a bit of harmony on the council. You know, there are towns where there are real disputes, and I know we've had some discussion in the past about the relocation of a truck stop there that was rather controversial. But, you know, for the most part, it seems that people work pretty well in concert with each other.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, and that's one of the things, and I would tell you that's probably one of the reasons why I've stayed as long as I've had, is I've had great mayors and city councils that I've worked for. And I think part of that is they can disagree but not take it personally. And I think that's a real key on the success of any city council is that, you know, they can – have a real debate on something, like you mentioned the truck stop. Yeah. And it can be a 3-2 vote. And after that, they're still getting along and they're still friends. And stuff after that is 5-0. It doesn't linger on. And I think that's a real key of why Story City has been successful over the year. And I tell people, what you may consider my worst council member is going to be the best on most city councils in the state of Iowa. And frankly, looking through all the people I've had the pleasure of working for, I've never had a bad city council member, but they've always been very good. And I think the real key's always been, Paul, they've got one agenda item, what's best for Story City.
You know, that's wonderful. And, you know, when you drive through northwest Iowa or areas that where the population loss is so dramatic, there are vacant farms, the business district is boarded up. And so when you see towns like Story City, it retains your faith in rural Iowa. You know.
It does. I think it's a great example of what a community can do that is willing to invest its time and invest its money into things. It just doesn't happen. It really takes some planning and it takes some investment for that to happen. And I think that's where a lot of small towns really fall by the wayside. They expect it's going to happen by the outside. They expect it's going to be grants from the federal or state that's going to take care of it. And they aren't necessarily willing to invest in it. And I think that's one of the things that we're willing to do.
Well, Mark, thank you for
being
with us today, and things look bright for Story City, and I'm glad to hear that you're looking so far ahead in these long-term incremental plans, and the best is yet to come. Thanks for speaking with us today. Now, today, right after you leave, we're going to play some music now that's evocative of small towns everywhere. It's Dolly Parton, My Tennessee Mountain Home.
On a summer afternoon, in a straight back chair on two legs, leaned against the wall. Watch the kids playing with June bugs on a string, and chase the glowing fireflies when evening shadows fall. In my Tennessee mountain home, life is as peaceful as a baby's sigh. In my Tennessee mountain home, fence along the lane. Their fragrance makes the summer wind so sweet. And on a distant hilltop, an eagle spreads its wings. And a songbird on a fence post sings a melody. You love just laughing, talking, making future plans. And when the folks ain't looking, you might steal a kiss or two, sitting in the porch swing holding hands. In my Tennessee mountain home, life is as peaceful as a baby's sigh.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Radio. I'm Isaac Beal, here with co-hosts Paul Wierson and Dalton Gackle. So far today, we've talked about the rise of some insects here in Iowa. We've heard what's new in Story City, and that song that just played was My Tennessee Mountain Home by Dolly Parton. This is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. We have been joined by Nicole Jonas and her son Gabe, the owner of Red Granite Farm. Thanks for coming in today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so for some of our listeners, I guess, that might have driven by or seen your farm, where is Red Granite Farm located at?
We're about 10 miles west of Story City on E-18 in northeastern Boone County.
Okay, so what kind of farmer are you? Like, what do you guys grow there?
We have about 5 acres, and 3 of it is planted in vegetables, and grow all the summer vegetables, sweet corn, pumpkins for fall. We also have a high tunnel that we produce our tomatoes and our peppers in, and we grow about 5,000 hardy perennials every year.
So what do you do with your crops? Like, who do you sell those to, or where do they go after they're done?
Most of the vegetables are sold at the farmers markets here in Story County. We do Ames Main Street on Saturday mornings, and we do Story City on Tuesday afternoons, and North Grand Mall on Wednesday afternoons.
How did you decide that you wanted to sell the more local sellers of the produce?
My husband and I met at Iowa State in the Department of Horticulture and have developed a business out of 2 different loves of horticulture. Mine is ornamental horticulture, where I do the growing of the perennials and landscape designing, whereas his interest is more in food crops. So with that, we then built Red Granite Farm and kind of focus on both of those things.
Okay, so is it you two that run the farm, or is Gabe taking over?
Going into third grade, right, Gabe? Now, Gabe, what do you do on the farm?
I don't know.
Gabe's a big helper. His favorite job is washing the cherry tomatoes, right?
Right.
And what did you and Dad do on Sunday together before the storm came?
Digged potatoes.
Yeah. And what else do we have on our farm? What animal do we have?
Chickens.
Yeah. We sell eggs to a bakery, and hopefully we'll have enough to sell them at the farmer's market soon. But we have about 550 laying hens.
Oh, nice.
On our farm as well. So the kids get pretty involved when they can. Gabe has an older sister and a younger brother, and because my husband and I both grew up on a farm, we really wanted to give our kids a farm life, but knew that probably the way we did it with corn and soybeans and livestock wasn't going to happen. So we're trying to do it our own way.
Yeah, that's sort of like an evolution in like the farm industry right now, isn't it? Is that happening more like at other farms around?
When you can't own a lot of land or a lot of big equipment, you try to do the best with the size of a farm that you have. Mm-hmm. And so growing local produce and then selling it at the farmer's market really gets you tied to your community, and also trying to use the land that you have to make a living.
Okay, so we brought you in today because recently you had the opportunity to be a part of a unique educational project. You actually gave a virtual tour of your farm. Tell us a little bit about that, like exactly what is the virtual tour of a farm like?
We've done it a couple times now. It started with just local schools, and then it turned into actually Skyping with kids from Las Vegas. We were able to do this opportunity through the Iowa Farm Bureau. Polk County Ag in the Classroom and Story County Ag in the Classroom have both contacted us to Skype with kids locally here in Ames, and then now all the way in Las Vegas. So the opportunity came up, and I love teaching kids about the farm and teaching them that not all chickens are raised in big commercial buildings and not all vegetables are produced in South America. So we got to talk to them about how our chickens live and how we take care of them, and then what they eat and how the vegetable garden even supplements them too.
Now, these were in Las Vegas inner-city children,
yes,
right?
Yes, they
And they
were.
Had no idea where the food comes from.
Yes.
Did we get any feedback from them?
It was interesting that...
Because you were Skyping with them.
Right. Yeah. And the thing that they were most curious about was what the nests look like, because I kept talking about how they lay their eggs in the nest. Well, kids generally think a nest is built out of sticks mm-hmm. and straw, and so they were confused. They're like, those metal boxes are nests? It's like, oh, yes, that's a laying box where a chicken will lay an egg. So... do you remember how many chickens we have right now, Gabe?
550, about.
Yeah, so...
Gabe, do you pick eggs? Do you gather eggs?
I used to.
But he gave it up for Lent, right? I used to pick eggs, too.
Sometimes...
Do they still have clucky hens?
Well, they can be awfully
yeah,
noisy.
Yeah, they can be fussy. Yeah.
Yeah. But Skyping with them gives them a great way to see a farm of our size, and also not have to step foot on the farm. There's a lot of biosecurity things with poultry. Last year we had the scare of the AI and the avian influenza, and so it's really cool that there are these opportunities to reach out to kids and adults both about what we do and how we do it without even having to have them visit. So
what made you want to be a part of this whole project, and how did you get chosen for it, or did you have to apply?
Just a friend that works for Polk County Ag in the Classroom approached me about it, and so they're always looking for farmers to volunteer. A neighbor of ours has a cattle operation, and they started over at her farm, and the kids, I guess, just went crazy when they heard a cow moo. So you think of, you know, growing up in Iowa, you probably have heard cows moo a lot, but a kid in Las Vegas maybe has never heard a real cow moo.
Yeah.
And they also, you know, when the chickens were cackling and making all their noise, they were like, you know, what is that noise? And so we had to go outside to talk to them because it was so loud in there.
And chickens. You made sure the kids knew that the chickens had access to be outdoors, too.
Right.
They could walk outdoors.
Of course, yeah. Our chickens are free range within a pen because of our vegetable gardens and our dog. But, yeah, they got to see how they get to go outside. They get to stay inside. They have fresh water and feed, and the eggs are picked up every day and washed. Some of the kids that we talked with here in Ames even got to see the egg washing machine. So,
oh, nice.
Because we're licensed to sell eggs to a commercial bakery, we have to wash them and process them. So,
well, also, you have drive-by traffic, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
People driving in?
Oh,
how,
yeah.
How often does that happen?
Well, we're open on Fridays out at the farm right now for the perennial sales. And, of course, you can buy vegetables while you're there, too. But... for the most part, the perennials will stay home from the farmer's market now, and it'll be sweet corn season coming soon. So
you have sweet corn also?
Yep. We grow sweet corn, potatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers, all your summer vegetables to sell at the farmer's market and from the farm if you happen to catch us.
So for, like, the kids in Las Vegas, it's probably important to see, like, they just get their food probably straight from, like, the markets and things like that. They don't know where it comes from probably
exactly.
because Las Vegas is in the middle of kind of – there's city and then there's desert. So
right.
were there any unique reactions to, like, the food that they saw being grown?
Yeah, I think that they were interested to see all the green probably.
Well, yeah, they live in such an arid area.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
Because I was in the Army in Tucson, and what I really missed was trees.
Yeah.
You know, I on the way back to Iowa, I saw a tree in Oklahoma, and I just about got out and hugged it.
Yeah. It's so different. We take it for granted, all the green here, and the fact that our food can be grown so close to home, that you literally can buy a cabbage at the farmer's market that was picked that morning, and you can eat it for supper that night. And you think about a cabbage you buy at the grocery store, how long it rode on a truck, mm-hmm. how long it sat in a cooler, and, you know, how many days it really was before, since it was picked.
Are you guys in the works to, like, set up things with other schools from other cities like Las Vegas?
We're always open for Skyping and for teaching kids about agriculture. So, yeah, we'll work with Iowa Farm Bureau or anybody that wants to learn more about what we do. We're very open about our farm. We, you know, welcome visitors. But we also have this unique opportunity to do it across the whole country through technology.
I would like to see you Skype to a PS, you know, public school in Brooklyn.
There you go.
Get you to see those kids. Hey, I've never seen that before.
Yeah.
Wow, look at that, Tommy. So, you know, education is important, and I hope you have some classes that come and tour, too, from schools. Does that happen?
We do. Did your class come this spring, Gabe?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Well, so, when Gabe, when your class came, were you the host? Did you show everybody around and wear a tie or what?
No.
He did a good job leading the kids. And that was the other thing, too. You know, just even kids in our own backyard don't realize how some things are grown. And I would ask them, you know, this. Guess what plant this is? And they'd say, orange. I'm like, no, oranges don't grow in Iowa, you know. So kids think just because it's accessible at the grocery store that it grows here, and that's not true on a whole lot of things that kids eat. So if we can teach them, you know, what things are grown locally and how you can support your local community by eating seasonally and trying to buy things that are in season. You know, if you really want a watermelon in May, can you just wait till July? Then you can buy one that's fresh from your neighbor.
Well, you know, the great thing is I call it the return of truck farming.
Mm-hmm.
That is orchards and produce like you have. And the history of this is that Iowa was very big in truck farming. And then there was the blizzard of 1940.
Killed a lot of orchards.
And then the war came. And then you had more monoculture, beans and corn.
Right.
And so only in recent decades has the truck farming in Iowa actually returned.
And it's provided us an opportunity to farm and not have to have a ton of investments, which so far has worked pretty good. It's not without its labor.
All right. Well, we have been speaking with Nicole Jonas, who farms Red Granite Farm in Boone County. They have been part of a project bringing a virtual farm tour to kindergartners in Las Vegas. Thank you guys for coming in and sharing your story with us.
And it's Gabe.
Gabe,
thank you, buddy.
You want to say hi to anybody on the radio, Gabe?
Yeah, was it fun?
Say hi to Dad and Nolan. They might be listening.
Hi, Dad. Hi, Nolan.
Okay.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Isaac Beal, one of your hosts today, along with Dalton Gackle and Paul Wearson. Thanks, Nicole Jonas, for talking about the virtual tour of your farm. Earlier in the show, we heard Donald Lewis, an entomology professor at Iowa State, discussing bugs, the rise in earwigs, and Japanese beetles in Iowa this summer. We also heard from Story City's city administrator, Mark Jackson, about the going on in Story City and about managing small towns in populated and rural Iowa. Thanks to all of our guests today.
Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There, you will also find contact information and the links for all the people and places we've talked about. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also listened to Buggin' Out by A Tribe Called Quest and My Tennessee Mountain Home by Dolly Parton.
KHOY is a community radio station that's driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. You can become a member or donate at any time by using our website, khoyfm.org, and just look for the big donate button. If you would like to join our local talk team or radio station, contact us at 515-292-2878. That number again, 515-292-2878. Or go to our website, khoyfm.org. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends, and remember, your participation as a listener and supporter is what makes KHOY possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening today, and we'll see you again on the radio.